Our text this week is Daniel chapter 8. If you recall, last week we began this second half of Daniel that I joked is the one everyone skips because it is very difficult. These are all apocalyptic visions that Daniel is receiving from the Lord. And if you recall, that kind of language is intended to be difficult to interpret. It's intending to be mysterious. So don't beat yourself up if you're not understanding everything. And like I said, the way to interpret it best is to see how the New Testament does this for us. Now, in this chapter, we actually have divine commentary given to us as Gabriel tells Daniel what things mean. It doesn't clear up every mystery, though, necessarily. And if you recall, the best way to interpret this kind of literature is the way you do an impressionist painting. You stand back at more of a distance and look at the beautiful picture. Makes sense then. But getting too zoomed in will inevitably lead to a lot of mess and a picture that makes no sense. So, we saw four kingdoms being foretold in last week's vision that copied the four kingdoms seen in the vision of the statue in chapter 2. This week, Daniel's vision is kind of zooming in on kingdom 2 and 3 in the succession of those four. And God is giving Daniel something that is going to make him very upset, very disturbed, hearing what's going to take place during the time particularly of the Greeks. And this takes place in between the two testaments. We know it from the books of Maccabees and Esdras and the Apocrypha. I'm not saying they're scripture, I'm just saying they're fairly reliable historical accounts of what took place. And though Daniel's appalled at this, and we'll see why, God is doing something very gracious here. This chapter is very much learning how we wait on the Lord. And Daniel's going to have to do some waiting, or so the people of God are going to have to wait longer than Daniel thought for relief. And what we see here is kind of like a note, or in these days a text. If someone was going to be home late from work, a loved one, if they don't tell you, you're worried, rightfully. Where are they? They were supposed to be here hours ago. However, if they give you an advance warning, a text, a note, I'm work late tonight, don't wait up for me, it's going to be after midnight. It might still be difficult without them there, particularly if you're a parent of young kids and you wish they were there, but you're not worrying. They gave you an advance notice, and so you can rest. That's what God's doing for his people here, but also for us, because while this is specifically focusing on the ruler Antiochus Epiphanes, who was a Greek ruler, and oppress the people of God, he is a foreshadowing very much of the Antichrist who will oppress God's people at the end. Seeing God sustain his people through this and have things happen exactly as he foretold helps the people of God know that in the future we can trust our God. When he tells us what's going to happen in the future, it will happen just as he says. We don't need to doubt. So with my sermon throat clearing out of the way, hear now the word of the Lord, Daniel chapter 8, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after that which appeared to me at the first. And I saw in the vision, and when I saw, I was in Susa, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision that I was at the Ulai Canal. I raised my eyes and saw, and behold, a ram standing on the bank of the canal. It had two horns, and both horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher one came up last. I saw the ram charging westward and northward and southward. No beast could stand before him, and there was no one who could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased and became great. As I was considering, behold, a male goat came from the west across the face of the whole earth without touching the ground, and that goat had a conspicuous horn between its eyes. He came to the ram with the two horns, which I had seen standing on the bank of the canal, and he ran at him with his powerful wrath. I saw him come close to the ram, and he was enraged against him and struck the ram and broke his two horns. And the ram had no power to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled on him, and there was no one who could rescue the ram from his power. Then the goat became exceedingly great, but when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and instead of it, there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Out of one of them, came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. It grew great, even to the host of heaven. And some of the host and some of the stars it threw down to the ground and trampled on them. It became great, even as great as the prince of the host. And the regular burnt offering was taken away from him, and the place of his sanctuary was overthrown. And a host will be given over to it, together with a glorious burnt offering because of transgression. And it will throw truth to the ground, and it will act and prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking. And another holy one said to the one who spoke, "For how long is the vision concerning the regular burnt offering, the transgression that makes desolate, and the giving over of the sanctuary and host to be trampled underfoot?" And he said to me, "For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state. When I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it. And behold, there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, and it called, 'Gabriel, make this man understand the vision.' So he came near where I stood. And when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, 'Understand, O son of man, that the vision is for the time of the end.' And when he had spoken to me, I fell into a deep sleep with my face to the ground. But he touched me and made me stand up. He said, 'Behold, I will make known to you what shall be at the latter end of the indignation, for it refers to the appointed time of the end. As for the ram that you saw with the two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia. And the goat is the king of Greece. And the great horn between his eyes is the first king. As for the horn that was broken, in place of which four others rose, four kingdoms shall rise from his nation, but not with his power. And at the latter end of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their limit, a king of bold face, one who understands riddles, shall rise. His power shall be great, but not by his own power. And he shall cause fearful destruction and shall succeed in what he does and destroy mighty men and the people who are the saints. By his cunning, he shall make deceit prosper under his hand. And in his own mind, he shall become great. Without warning, he shall destroy many. And he shall even rise up against the prince of princes, and he shall be broken, but by no human hand. The vision of the evenings and the mornings that has been told is true. But seal up the vision, for it refers to many days from now. And I, Daniel, was overcome and lay sick for some days. Then I rose and went about the king's business, but I was appalled by the vision and did not understand it." The word of the Lord. Okay, kids, that was a hard passage of the Bible to understand, wasn't it? Just like last week's. But God gave it to us for a reason. He wants us to help. He wants to help us do something that's not easy for any of us. And what do you think that is? That this part of the Bible will help us do that's not easy? Waiting patiently for God to answer our prayers. Is that easy for any of you kids? Nope. How many of you love waiting in line, especially at the back of the line? Does anyone love waiting in line? How many of your parents love being in traffic? Don't they say, "Oh, look, a traffic jam, yes"? Nope. None of us like to wait, right? Especially when there's something really important to us and we're asking God to give it to us. And sometimes God gives it right away. Sometimes God never does. Sometimes God makes you wait and wait and wait. Why would God do that? Why can't he just give us what we want when we want it? Because God knows what's best for us. And we don't get to decide what's best for us. God knows, and he knows that sometimes when he makes us wait, it actually makes us trust him more. It makes us go to him in prayer more. And Daniel saw things he was going to have to wait for, or at least the people of God were going to have to wait for, and it made him very upset. But we saw that God reminded him, "I'm going to keep my promise to you. Just wait." And so Daniel waited. And one reason you can know God will never break his promises to you is because he's promised to save you and love you through Jesus. He doesn't keep his promises if you do enough yourself. Or if you wait patiently enough, then I'll keep the promise. He'll always do what he promised because he can't break it. And he's always going to love you because he gave you Jesus. So when God's making you wait, you don't have to doubt that he loves you. If you love me, you wouldn't make me wait, God. No, he's growing you when he makes you wait and helping you be more like Jesus. Isn't that great that he makes that help you be stronger instead of weaker? Because he loves you? Can you think about ways to thank him and ask him to help you wait well, help you be patient during the sermon? Because you're going to have to wait for the end of that too. So thanks for listening, guys. So, as I said, this is about waiting. Why was Daniel so upset? I mean, Gabriel kind of spelled it out pretty clearly, like really clearly. This is the Medes and Persians. This is the Greeks. Medes and Persians are going to be really strong. Greeks are going to beat them up. One really strong king is at the height of his power is going to be cut down. Four other kingdoms are going to come up. One of them is going to oppress the people in the promised land. When it talks about the glorious land, it's the promised land. And you're not going to be allowed to offer sacrifices for 2,300, either 2,300 days, or scholars are divided. It could be referring to 2,300 morning and evening sacrifices, in which case it would be a little over 1,100 days. Either way, it's going to be over at that exact time, and things will resume. Well, it's like, that's a real gimme when it comes to apocalyptic literature, right? Divine commentary. This means that, this means that. And Daniel seems more upset than anything else, like the crazy beasts from last week. I think Daniel and all the exiles had in mind, we find out next week, Daniel's looking, he's looking at the clock, 70 years, and it's up, and we're getting near it. And then we go home, we rebuild the temple, and then everything will be great. And Daniel has just found out, no, it won't. In fact, it's going to be worse than anything you've gone through. No Canaanite thug that beat them up when they were in the promised land, not Nebuchadnezzar, not the Persians, ever sought to completely eradicate the worship of Yahweh. In fact, typically they're saying, yeah, get him on our side too. And typically, Israel didn't need any help. They're just like, oh, cool, Baal, let's go worship. Okay. People would entice them, but they never tried to wipe it out. Well, we know this king that's specifically being referred to, the little horn that's going to do all this damage, is Antiochus Epiphanes. So keep in mind, this is still in the reign of Belshazzar. The Medes and Persians haven't even come yet. So Daniel's learning for the first time what that second kingdom is going to be. He knew there was going to be four from the statue, and the first was Nebuchadnezzar. Now he finds out the Medes and Persians are going to come in. Nothing's going to stop them. But when it looks like they're totally unstoppable, another force, the Greeks, are going to come in from the west as if they weren't even on the ground. This conquest is going to be so quick and so huge. And that's absolutely Alexander the Great. And he's the one horn that grows up exceedingly great. But at the height of his power, Alexander's 33 years old. He's just conquered the world. Boom, he's dead. And as we know, his kingdom was then divided into four. That's the four horns that rise up after that. And it's a very tumultuous time. Trying to chart what happens historically there is very, very, very difficult. But Antiochus Epiphanes is the one who's the great king toward the south, to the glorious land. And he sought this rigorous Hellenizing program, probably as a temper tantrum against the Romans, who were kind of holding his leash to a degree. And he got resistance from the Jews. And so he absolutely demanded no worship of Yahweh, no sacrifices. He, to show how much he was sticking it to them, sacrifices a pig on their altar, the height of something unclean, the most offensive thing he could do. He sacrifices a pig. He burns and cuts up any scrolls, any book of the law he can find, any scripture he can find. If anyone circumcises their babies, those babies are put to death. And he killed thousands upon thousands who resisted him. I think being carried off to Babylon as an exile would have been far more welcomed than this. If you know the story, the Jews rise up, and it's a phenomenal, incredible story. As God raises up Judas Maccabeus, and they fight, and they fight, and they fight, and finally, it's interesting, the way you calculate it, the specific altar was taken down for probably about 1,150 days, and the time of Antiochus' oppression was kind of like 2,300 days. So depending on how you slice it, they both are looking just like God said. The detail in this passage has been what make people say this had to be written after the Maccabean revolt. How in the world could you predict with this precision? Well, that's what our God does, right? Talk about leaving you a note about what's going to happen. I'm getting home exactly, precisely this time. Don't worry. But without this advance notice from God, when they thought we're going to go home, we're going to rebuild the temple, and then we're going to slowly get better and better, imagine what they might have thought. The temple's in worse shape than it's ever been. Where's God? He didn't owe them this. But that's the kind of God we serve. And again, Antiochus, the little horn, is not the little horn from last week's vision, but he's like the little horn from last week's vision, the one who will oppress and wipe out, seek to wipe out the worship of Yahweh, demand worship of himself with great power, and will succeed for a time. But the elect will not be deceived, and the Lord will come and rescue. And so, as Daniel is finding out, we are going to have to wait a long time for all that we've been looking forward to. He's sick over this. But by the end, he gets up and he goes about the king's business. He's still appalled. He's dreading it. But he gets up and he goes about the king's business. How can God help us? And how does this passage help us wait on the Lord? And what we're wanting is a good thing. But he is deciding not to give it to us at this time. How do we resist the devil's desires for us to turn on him and accuse him of being an unloving God? So, first, he helps us wait by preparing us for the suffering we face. That's our first point. He helps us wait by preparing us for the suffering we're going to face. And then because so many of the things that cause our suffering are powers and authorities in this world, our second point is he puts the powers of this world in perspective. He puts the powers of this world in perspective. And then finally, he comforts us with his sovereignty. So he comforts us with his sovereignty. So, as we are reminded of how this passage is helping us wait, remember again the note saying, I'm going to be home late. The way you could worry if you didn't have any information giving you advance notice. And God flat out tells us the world will hate you. They hate me. Jesus says that they're going to hate you. Expect suffering. Expect opposition. Expect people to find the gospel foolish and offensive. Remember we talked a few weeks ago. We are the aroma of death to those who are in a rebellion against God. As we talk about needing a savior, those who don't want a savior, don't want to bow a knee, are reminded, there's a death sentence hanging over my head that I know about. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to think about needing to be saved. We are also, Paul says, the aroma of life to those who are believing, reminding each other of the hope we have. So if prosperity gospel was true, we should all be in serious, serious doubt. That's why it's such a vicious, vicious, easy-to-believe lie. We all want to think that if I just muster up enough faith, I get whatever I want. And that if I'm doing good, God owes me a nice life. We all would love to think that. But absolutely, the scripture says, don't listen to that. And that's what false prophets were always telling God's people. Peace, peace, when there is no peace. Telling people what they wanted to hear. And so, God does not promise you your best life now. Praise him for that. I'd rather have my best life in eternity, not the one that's over soon. And if we fall for those prosperity gospel, name it, claim it, if you muster up enough faith, you'll get whatever you want, that ought to cause you a serious crisis of faith, because when you don't get what you want, what do they always tell you? You didn't believe hard enough, it's your fault. But still, send a check to my ministry. Again, we can make fun of the TV preachers, and I don't think too many of us are currently operating under their influence. If you are, I would love to free you from it. Okay. But I think we fall into this mentality when we think, I'm doing the right things in life. Not necessarily I've named it and I've claimed it and God owes it to me, but I'm doing the right thing. I'm the one person at work not cutting corners. I'm the one person not cheating on their taxes. I'm the one person trying to actually raise my kids well. I'm the one person in this marriage who's trying to be godly. go on and on. And then we think, now God owes me reward for that, and reward on my terms, of course. And if I'm suffering in the midst of trying to do the right thing, how dare God put me through this? He owes me my best life now. And you might not say the words, how dare you put me through this, God, but our anger, our frustration, our indignance, whatever our sinful responses are, say it for us. And I know I have certainly been in this place where you can then begin to just flat out doubt. Doubt that God is the loving God he promises to be. And there's nowhere the devil wants you to be more than that. So we need to be grateful that God tells us this world's going to be difficult to live in. Trust me. I am coming for you. You are going to be home someday. But expect this side of heaven to be difficult. Again, the analogy I give you all the time, we need to view our journey right now like Israel in the desert on the way to the promised land. We've been freed from slavery to sin, just like they were freed from slavery in Egypt. And God sustains us now by feeding us with Christ, like he fed them with the bread from heaven and the water from the rock, both pictures of Christ. But the journey was difficult, and they stumbled and they fell into terrible things often. If God hadn't sustained them, they never would have made it. But they got there. And all his promises came true. And we are most certainly in a wilderness of this world. But God is sustaining us. He will not forsake us. And you're going to get there. So while now you are asking the Lord for good things that he may not be giving to you, don't let that suffering convince you that God is unreliable. Don't let that pain of waiting convince you that you deserve better than this. The wages of sin is death. That's what we deserve. I don't say it flippantly, but anything better than that is better than we deserve. And I say that with fear and trembling. So, don't fall into the good things ought to happen to good people, and I'm one of the good guys, and then be angry at God when we don't get what we want. Yearn with the Lord. Plead with him. The Lord honors that. But what does he say in Romans 5? These trials produce character. When I make you wait, it's because I'm helping you rely on me more. When we are made to wait, we cling often more desperately to our God. We are more often in prayer, more realizing how much we absolutely depend on him for everything. When you always get what you want, right away, you don't feel that. The Lord knows when we need to feel that. And I don't think any of us should be arrogant enough to ask God to make us wait a long time. Pour on the suffering, God, I can take it. Please, please don't ever pray prayers like that. Because they're really arrogant, right? We can say, mold me and shape me like Christ, and please be merciful how you do that. So we all love to think like Maria in The Sound of Music, right? Nothing comes from nothing. Nothing ever could. So somewhere in my youth or childhood, I must have done something good. Isn't it great when I can bash musicals theologically? I come really from the wrong family to be trying that, but anyway. So here we see a picture where God is reminding them, like he does with plenty of New Testament scriptures for us, you are going to experience hardship in the future. The finish line you thought you had is farther down the road than you thought. And that can be a really devastating thing, particularly when we are made to wait for progress in fighting against sin. And when we have been treating it like a sprint, and all of a sudden here we are flat on our face, out of breath. How did this happen? I thought I was doing so well. You thought you only had a few steps. You thought that thing in the future, there was the finish line. It was just a marker. This is a double marathon. Well, okay, now I don't have to just be totally devastated. Where are your promises, God? Oh, yeah, this I can't afford to treat this like part you, part me. And when it's when the finish line's close, I can do some of that in my own strength. When I'm made to wait for progress, I'm made to be aware I can do none of this on my own strength. I must rely on you for every step of the way to remind me of what is holy, to convict me of what is wrong, and to remind me of what is good when you tell me you love me in spite of the sin, that you've paid for it with Christ, and then help me to love what you love. But that's a process that's going to take our whole lives. And we will make progress. You are closer to the finish line. You just haven't met it yet. It's good to ask God continually for help in these times when we are made to wait for deliverance, made to wait for relief, for healing, or for progress in sin, in fighting against sin, sorry. You can't be a pest to God. You can't pray too much about something. All of us could and should pray more than we currently do. And making us wait by preparing us in advance, it's going to happen. Don't be surprised and don't doubt that I'm loving. My waiting produces good things in you. We can then go about the king's business ourselves without being totally devastated. So Daniel was filled with dread, but God's intent was not to induce dread. And God's intent by telling us, you're going to suffer in this world, is not to make us fret and be fearful. I'm afraid to go out into the world. They're going to hate me because they hate Christ. He tells us in advance to comfort us so that we can know, I love you. I wanted to soften the blow on this. I didn't want you wondering what was happening. So I've told you in advance. Don't be surprised when it happens, and don't doubt that I love you when it happens, so you can continue taking another step toward the promised land. It should fill us with comfort that he prepares us in advance. What we also see in this vision is that God puts the powers of this world in perspective. Now, specifically, what's causing Daniel this dread and what he's going to have to now wait longer for are actual kingdoms that are going to oppress God's people. So I'm not concerned that you are being oppressed by other earthly armies. And there, look here to how Daniel approaches this. World powers are what God puts in perspective here. If he puts some of the mightiest nations in the history of the world in proper perspective, how much more the things that we suffer under? So you aren't being oppressed by rogue armies. Whatever it is you are suffering from, asking the Lord to deliver you from, and that he's making you wait for, watch how he puts these powers that oppress in perspective. So, Daniel again is living in the height of Babylon's power. It's starting to wane a little bit under Belshazzar, but he's told that next kingdom's coming, and that ram is charging left and right. Nothing can stand in its way, except the next kingdom that wipes it out really easily. And that one's going to cover the world, and that horn is growing exceedingly great. Nothing can stand before it till it shatters. And that monolithic kingdom is now four squabbling ones. And Rome's going to come put them in their place too. Things that look completely overwhelming, and to us are. Daniel wouldn't have any power to stop one of those kingdoms from coming and doing what it does. But they are nothing for God. Nothing. The whole world could not withstand them, and they are nothing for God. And things happen exactly as he said, showing this is my plan. We're actually going to skip chapter 11 in this sermon series because chapter 11 just zooms way more in on this exact period. Read it, though. The detail, you'll need about 18 commentaries next to you as well to get through it. But the detail given in chapter 11 is just incredible. It's almost like he's saying, and then this king's going to come. He's going to have a crooked canine tooth on the right side of his mouth. He's got bushy eyebrows, a few streaks of gray. It's that kind of detail almost. Like, the Lord's sovereignty is just incredibly displayed. So read that one. It's homework. But it tells you the same story as this vision here, to prepare God's people for so much detail of what's to come. As the Jews have relayed the history of this time, when Alexander came and conquered, it was a peaceful takeover. And he, like others, like the freedom they'd known under the Babylonians and the Persians were allowed to worship. They brought the scripture, they brought Daniel, book of Daniel to Alexander and showed him, this is you. And he offered a sacrifice to God. Great, another one on my side. He didn't believe, but they were prepared. They were watching this unfold before their eyes and believed it. They were prepared for what was happening by the Lord, that he gave this to them in advance. So, what is oppressing you? What are you suffering under that you're begging the Lord to change and he's seen fit not to do it yet? I know of tons of medical things that people in this room are facing, financial woes that people are facing, struggling marriages that people are facing, difficult scenes at work that you're facing. And I've probably just scratched the surface of what is making you suffer and things you're asking the Lord to change. He's not told you in advance, oh, I'm going to get you a new job in 2,300 days. He's not giving you that information. He's guaranteed you he'll never leave you or forsake you. He's guaranteed you he will walk with you through whatever you're facing. He has promised you he will continue to love you like he loves Christ throughout all this, and that he'll use this to make you more like him. He's also promised you life will not always remain this way. You can't claim more than that, right? But you can know your suffering is not him being deaf to you. Your suffering is not his anger at you. Your suffering is not him ignoring you. One of the things I love about this vision is that it shows another perspective. Not only are the world powers nothing for God, but you would think by reading this vision that the greatest king is Antiochus Epiphanes, the little horn. Look how much the text zooms in on him. Historically, he's nothing. He didn't come close to the grandeur of Alexander the Great. But the Bible shows here, God is zoomed in on his people in the midst of this. What happens on the world stage doesn't matter nearly as much to God as what happens to his people that he has taken to himself. And so it might seem like God had neglected them. He told them in advance what will happen, and then he shows, and I'm huddled up right here around you guys during this time. This is what I focus on. The world stage can come and go. But I am right there with you in the midst of your suffering. It is not my absence. It's my molding you and shaping you and helping you cling to me more. We would all love to not need suffering and not need waiting to be made more like Christ. But God does what is best for us, not always what we want. And that's what loving parents do. They make their kids eat the food they don't want to eat because it's healthy and it makes them strong. And so we have to trust our Father that our difficult times and times when he's making us wait are not worthless and they're not his absence. He zooms in on us during those times. And so there's another perspective for us to take. Whatever it is that's oppressing you is nothing for God to change. And his choice not to change it for you is not his ignoring you. And it is not his lack of care for you. It is what's happening according to his plan. Because he knows what's best. And some of the things that people in this room have gone through, I cannot imagine. What God is taking some of you through is just incredible. And I know for many of you, it's not over. So don't hear me treating what you're waiting through lightly, please. I just want to encourage you that it is not taking God by surprise, and he has planned this for your good. That doesn't mean I'm telling you to stop crying. It just means in the midst of your tears, don't think this is God zooming out and looking away from you. He shows here, he zooms in and surrounds you in the midst of it. So those powers that are oppressing you are not who's in charge. God is the one who's in charge. God is the one who's sovereign. And so our final point is that's how we can walk forward in these difficult times without fear. Because this is all his plan, and he has promised that he will do everything because of his love for us. Not because he just wants to ignore us and do what he feels like doing. Remember, I said this is chapter 2 and 3 of a 4-part chapter. Remember last week we saw kingdoms 1 through 4. Please remember what takes place at the end of last week's vision. These 4 kingdoms arise, 2 of which we have zoomed on in here. They all demand worship. They all threaten you if you don't. The third kingdom here will specifically oppress God's people. But then at the height of his power, he is destroyed by no human hand, our text said. And the details around Antiochus' death are mysterious, but he died of some kind of disease that was so painful, it drove him mad. It was by no human hand, exactly as God said. And the temple was restored, exactly as he said, after that short time. And his people were victorious, and he vindicated them, just as he said. But remember, on a bigger scale, last week, after the four kingdoms have come, and the final beast is too frightening for words, the Ancient of Days came in, sat on his throne, opened his books, and judged the beast and destroyed him. And the saints who had suffered were given the kingdom of the Son of Man that they enjoyed forever. We're in the midst of those four visions with these here. And we are reminded by last week's of what awaits all of us. That kingdom that the Son wins, he gives to us and we share with him. And nothing can take it away. And the credits on it will never roll. God may see fit to make you wait until you see him face to face before you get what you're asking for. And all of us are going to suffer in some way, shape, or form until we finally see him on that day. Maybe God will give you the temporary relief you're asking for. And we continue to pray for it. But we know we're going to experience a joy beyond what any temporary relief we can ask for forever. Because the Ancient of Days cannot lose. And he cannot break his promises to you. And the Son will be victorious when he returns to give us the spoils of his kingdom forever. So we've seen on the historical stage these things that God predicted in chapter 8 happen exactly as he says. And then when you read chapter 11, it's even more mind-boggling how detailed, and it all has already happened, just like he said. And so we look back at what he's done and see that when God says he's going to do something, he does it exactly how he says. And we then look forward to the day when we will all have the tears wiped from our eyes one last time, never to weep again. And say, he's going to do it exactly as he says, because that's what our God does. And if we are tempted to doubt, we look back at these uncanny, incredible prophecies made and promises kept. And say, then I'm not going to doubt you for the future. And you promised me I can even have joy this side of heaven when my prayers aren't answered, because you will sustain me. You will fill me with knowledge of your love that can produce joy in the midst of my tears. And as we then contemplate that, realizing he cannot stop loving you as much as he loves Christ, we can then be filled with confidence and reject what the devil wants us to believe. The devil wants you to believe that at best, this world is random and chaotic and meaningless. At worst, the devil wants you to believe you are governed by a cruel tyrant of a God. And when we are suffering, we are more susceptible to that lie than ever. Seeing this chapter today can preach to us, no, God is sovereign in the midst of all this. It's not just that he knows what's going to happen. He planned what's going to happen to a T, and it all happens exactly as he foretells. So my sufferings aren't random, and they aren't the work of a cruel God. They are his plan to mold me and shape me and help me see his love for me in a way that I wouldn't have if I didn't have to trust him like this in this time of trial. I pray that everything you guys are suffering right now, God changes. I certainly don't pray this on any of you. I pray that he doesn't make you wait any longer for the good things you're asking for. But I also pray that as long as all of us are made to wait, we will love our God more and be able to see how he provides for us in these difficult times and realize it's better than we deserve. Every one of those things is better than we deserve. And we can say, Lord, you took what I deserve. You took the wrath I deserve. How can I complain that you haven't given me what I want now? I'm still going to ask you to change it. I'm still going to ask you to deliver. But I will go and get up and get about your business and glorify you, because your grace is sufficient for me. And I pray that all of us can respond the way Paul did. He begged the Lord to take away whatever the tormentor from Satan was, whatever the thorn in his flesh was, begged him. Three times I pleaded with the Lord about this, that it should leave me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Why? Because when I'm aware of my weakness, I'm aware of how much I need him and how much he's done for me and how my only hope really is not how well I've been doing things or how well I've been getting what I want. My hope is in a Father who has promised he will always love me and never leave me or forsake me, and he will take me home exactly according to his plan. And he will take all of you as well, because your names are written in the book of life, and the Ancient of Days cannot lose. We serve him, we belong to him, and we're his children. Don't doubt his love in the midst of suffering. Ask him to allow you to feel it more than you ever have, and he will be faithful.